you were saying, did you have any more to say about the, this question of, the tribes,
Well, Americans, and again, John Wiley once made this comment, which I've often remembered. He said, Americans think that foreigners are Americans who wear funny hats. And, of course, therein lies our continuing tragedy in foreign affairs, where so many Americans, including our highest policymakers, time after time, really think that they can deal with some alien on terms which make sense to them as Americans. And of course the alien looks at them through entirely different eyes. I remember time after time a sensation going into the villages in Iran, and I had the sensation that the people there, sometimes they would feel as if they stretched out their hand and moved it toward me, that they would pass through my body, that I was as ethereal as though I had fallen from the sky. And these are totally different people. They're just totally different.
Now, the nationalization of Anglo-Iranian Oil Company became a central goal of the National Front by 1950-51. Now, how closely did you follow petroleum politics in Iran when you were the political section?
Yeah, really very little. And indeed, this just may be my memory, but I don't think mm-hmm. that Mossadegh and the majority of the Persian people who supported him were that concerned about the oil. What they were concerned about was throwing off the British yoke. Uh-huh. And the oil was the first, the oil apparatus was the first thing to strike at, was the clear thing to strike at. Now, I realize in saying that I'm being fanciful, because clearly there had to be an economic element to this. But again, time after time, it seems to me that the Americans, for instance, the fatuous Mr. Harriman, whose ridiculous mission worked on the principle that, as I remember, that the Iranians had to have an understanding of the oil and had to have a recognition that they couldn't just sell oil on the corner, was dealing with people who just didn't think in those terms. Mossadegh, I believe, expected to be rescued by the Americans. Mm. I simply don't think he expected to be left alone. He thought that he could drive out the British, that the Americans, like any respectable competitor, would welcome that, would happily move in and sell his oil. We didn't do it, and he fell.
Well, you suggested sort of that the oil company was sort of a symbol of British power, and that nationalization was a means towards an end of driving out British influence, political influence, and social influence. Could you get a sense of how the oil company operated, the AIOC operated in Iran during this period?
Yeah, I knew the Tehran hierarchy, the AIOC, uh-huh. and of course I knew British embassy people. Some very dear friends that I still have. Nicholas Lawford was the DCM in the British Embassy. He now lives in Long Island. John Bryant was one of the senior intelligence officers. He now is living in London. These are people I knew well, socially. And also we talked, obviously, about current affairs. And the AIOC was absolutely hand in glove with the embassy people. In fact, I think it would be fair to say that the AIOC had a much more dominant influence on British policy in Iran than the diplomats in the embassy. They used money. The AIOC used money, used old connections. They used them brutally, and I don't mean physical brutality, but just without much deftness, and the British embassy pretty much followed in their wake. This began to change as it became clear that the AIOC was simply incapable of handling the political difficulties. But, for instance, there was a senior man, they called him Oriental Counselors, Oriental Counselor, I think was the term. I remember Oriental. There's a man named Lance Pyman, was the British Oriental Counselor. He spoke absolutely fabulous Farsi. He had been involved with that country for many, many years. And he, as I remember, did not have any particular sense. He certainly had no prescience on the possibility, indeed probability, that the Persians would break the concession and drive the British out. Nicholas Lawford had a much more clear view and indeed resigned while he was there and left the British Foreign Service, not only out of frustration with policy, but I think that was a contributing factor in his decision.
Now you mentioned that Grady became ambassador, took over Wiley's position. I think this is around July 1950, according to my notes here. Now, how sympathetic was Grady to Mosaddegh and Mosaddegh's purposes?
Well, first of all, Grady came to Iran from India, as I remember, where he had been a very important ambassador in a very important country. Before that, he'd made his reputation in foreign affairs in Greece. And, of course, before that, he'd been a very successful, prominent businessman in the San Francisco area. I don't think he was thrilled about being appointed to Iran. I think he felt that he had taken a step down. I have no idea what his preferences would have been, but I clearly got the impression when he first arrived that he felt that he had moved from the center court to a smaller court. However, he's a very decent man, a very hard-working, honest man, and he identified the problems as he saw it and went to work on them. He was more at ease, I think, this is a very broad generalization, he was more at ease in economic policies, the use of aid, the development of economic relationships, than he was in the extremely Byzantine intrigues and games of more or less the diplomatic side of things. Again, looking back on Wiley and Dewar, those two men loved the intrigue. They moved through it like fish in water. Whether they had more impact, I don't know. I think there is always a danger of an American becoming too adept at the local game rather than simply representing a kind of an American attitude. But there was no question that Grady was well wired into the authorities in Washington, that he was a distinctly honest American representative, and I think he was a very good ambassador. I don't think any ambassador could have stopped the rise of Mossadegh or prevented the British being driven out, all things considered. But it was a great change from Wiley, and indeed when Loy Henderson came, he changed the involvement of the American ambassador into a much more subtle and diplomatic kind of relationship than Grady played.
Mm-hmm. During this period, Grady's first half year, like late 1950, the British and the Iranians are trying to negotiate a settlement over the oil prices, oil income, oil revenue that's going to Iran. Mm-hmm. AIOC's share of the take. has been discussed.
Mm-hmm.
The British were taking a relatively obdurate position,
mm-hmm.
And the talks with Mossadegh and the Iranian government. Did Grady make any efforts to convince the British to take a more flexible approach to the Iranians?
Grady would just groan when he would be back into the office writing his reports and talking with us.
Uh-huh.
He would groan at the obduracy of the British, blankness of their minds when it came to dealing with Iranians. I would say he was probably much more angered and frustrated by the English than he was by sweet old Mossadegh, although Mossadegh was a far more dangerous foe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Hmm. Now, you mentioned earlier General Rosmar's assassination, mm-hmm. I think it was at a mosque.
In the bazaar.
Mm-hmm. And this happened a few days after he spoke out against nationalization, which was becoming a rising demand of the National Front.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly thereafter, Majlis passed a bill to nationalize AIOC.
Mm-hmm.
And within a few months, Mossadegh became prime minister,
mm-hmm.
like May 51, something like that, something along that line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've read that policymakers in Washington worried around this time that successful nationalization would have a demonstration effect that it might encourage or inspire other governments with oil resources to nationalize foreign holdings, for example, Saudi Arabia or other Middle Eastern countries, or perhaps Venezuela in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
Was there much concern at the embassy about this issue?
I'm certain you're right about what was going on back in the United States. As to the embassy, I have no doubt that there was that general concern, but the embassy, as I remember it,
uh-huh.
and like most embassies, was really concentrating on the local scene.
Uh-huh.
However, the house that I then lived in, up in Gulhek, was part of a garden in which there was another house, and in that other house lived a man named Max Thornburg. And Max Thornburg was a great buccaneer in the oil world, who had been very successful working with Sultan of Bahrain, who I think, Sultan of Bahrain, anyhow, the Bahraini sheikh,
mm-hmm.
Who indeed I think had given him an island. In any case, Thornburg was up in Iran, living there, during this time. Now, I have absolutely no evidence, proof of this, but I am persuaded that Thornburg had lines of communication with the National Front. And Thornburg once told me one evening, just sitting around having a drink, he told me that if you drew a graph, I remember this so clearly because I thought it was so pertinent. If anyone draws a graph showing the life of a foreign concession, he meant oil concession, in any foreign country, the graph rises slowly in terms of profits. The graph rises slowly as the investing foreign firm develops and then begins to make money, and it rises up, and then there is always, inevitably, an abrupt fall as the concession is closed down. And he considered that to be a force of nature. And I do too. And I think he was proven right. I don't really think it's just some kook who decides to throw the foreigners out. It's as inevitable as the sun rising. And so the British, in my opinion, were struggling against a force of nature as well as Mossadegh led Iranians. And I doubt very much if officers of the American embassy thought that the British could remain in control for the next 100 years, or even 20 years, or even 2 years.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe the British response to nationalization. I mean, what did you think about the way they conducted themselves after Mosley passed a law nationalizing AIOC?
Well, I don't think they were very smart. I don't really have a great sense of or remembrance of details, mm-hmm. but they began to send in some very, very powerful intelligence officers, Woodhouse, Bryant's, men of great experience and real ability. I have read that they mounted a coup which didn't come off. I'm not really sure about that, but I do know they had absolute ace personnel in there working in the on the subversive side of the uh-huh. clandestine side.
Uh-huh.
They didn't change the quality of their embassy people much, but it sure got better than it had been before. And clearly, the British government was taking charge of things, and it was no longer just being run by the company. But if you ask me details of what they did and so on, it's too far away from me now.
Now, what this, I mean, these details that might escape you, but I read that even before Mossadegh became prime minister, the British had their own alternative candidate for prime minister, Zaid Zia Tabatabi. And they wanted to find ways to overthrow Mossadegh and install Zaid Zia as replacement. Did you know anything about this planning?
I certainly didn't know about any of the planning, I don't remember Tabatai anything more than just a face of a social function.
Now, while the British were developing their coup plans, some of which you mentioned yourself, the Truman administration was trying to find ways to settle the dispute by finding a basis for compromise between Mossadegh and the British government and AIOC. Did the embassy staff play any kind of a role in the effort to settle the dispute?
Well, yes, of course. I think the air was filled with Grady's telegrams and certainly his constant efforts to negotiate.
Uh-huh.
We'd get an instruction to take something up with Mossadegh and we'd make an appointment and Grady and I would go see the old man lying in his bed in his pajamas, and then we'd come back and send off a telegram. I don't think Grady ever despaired, but on the other hand, realistically, there was very little likelihood that Mossadegh would come to an accommodation with the British on any terms that the British could accept. That's about it. Then, of course, when the Harriman mission came out, typically Mr. Harriman, had nothing to do with the embassy and thought in 3 days or 10 days, whatever it was, he could solve these issues, these small people had not been able to deal with. And he and Walter Levy, who was a remarkable man, I hope you get his views, and, of course, Vernon Walters was the interpreter. And Vernon Walters, with his extraordinary ability, he learned enough Farsi in a few days, I mean 2 or 3 days, to be able to translate to some degree in Farsi before he left. He's a linguist of extraordinary genius. And he remembers those days. He and I have talked about them. But the mission was doomed. It was all a part of a policy, I believe, directed from Washington, mm-hmm. which, in my opinion, did not take true account of Mossadegh's intentions.
So Harriman's party totally avoided the embassy staff, basically?
No, hardly. They couldn't do that, but certainly they treated us. I mean, Harriman sort of blew in, established himself, and it's not uncharacteristic of other special envoys. Iran is, the American embassy in Iran has suffered special envoys long past Harriman's time. I happen to have a particular aversion to Mr. Harriman, who I think is one of the great disasters in American foreign policy, but with the Geneva Accords being his greatest contribution to our tragedy.
Now, apparently when Harriman met with the Shah, that's what I've read, he discussed with him the possibility of replacing Mossadegh as prime minister. Do you know if he would have cleared that with the ambassador before bringing it up with the...
I have no idea. I think I wouldn't. It would be perfectly in tune with his character if he didn't mention it to the ambassador. I don't think Harriman would do that sort of thing without having at least some clearance in Washington. But that's all I know.
Was there much discussion at the embassy during this period, 51, 52, of the idea of replacing Mossadegh?
Oh, that's a good question. I hadn't thought about it. And now that I do think about it, my answer is no. But I left Iran well before Mossadegh fell. I was desk officer. In other words, I came back to be desk officer when Acheson was still Secretary of State. Truman was still in power. And so I was desk officer when the decisions were made in Washington to dump Mossadegh. I don't personally remember anything like that being discussed when I was in the embassy.
But I remember
I was a fairly junior officer, and that kind of discussion would be, by its nature, would be held in the highest circles.
That's a question. In an interview that Grady gave shortly after he left Tehran, he argued that the main obstacle to a settlement with Mossadegh was the nationalist fear of future British political manipulation in Iran. For example, one of the sticking points in the negotiations was whether British technicians should help run a nationalized oil company or not. And I think most of their supporters objected because they feared any future British role in the country at the technical level or the managerial level. How accurate do you think Grady's appraisal was of this problem?
Well, again, I'm speaking in very general terms,
yes,
and you might say unprovable terms. My own personal feeling is now, and may have been then, but I don't remember thinking of it, was that Mossadegh had absolutely no intention of settling with the British on any terms that the British could accept. Despite his several offers of such settlements, I don't think that Mossadegh ever wanted to do anything except give the British a bloody nose. And, along with it, went his abiding assumption that the Americans would take care of him.
While the U.S. engaged itself in the discussions over a compromise of some sort, the administration back in Washington supported an international boycott of Iranian oil. The idea was to prevent Iran from enjoying the fruits of nationalization without compensation, because it had not been... conversations had not been arranged at that stage of the game. Do you know if Ambassador Grady supported this program of a boycott against oil exports from Iran?
I don't. I have a feeling that he simply received information on that sort of thing. He may have commented. But I do remember when I was desk officer and I was at a meeting in Secretary Acheson's office. I was by far the most junior person there and sort of sat off to one side, but I do remember they were talking at that moment about two tankers that were en route from, it seems to me, South America, en route to load Persian oil delivered by the Persian-run company. And there was a great deal of alarm and concern. And I remember sitting there in a rather bemused condition thinking, two tankers, who the hell cares? But there is no doubt in my mind that the senior policy makers in Washington were very, very alert to preventing the sale of Iranian oil to private entrepreneurs. And there's a man named, is it Jones of City Service? Yeah, City Service, the American oil company. Alton Jones?
Something? Yeah, Alton Jones. Alton Jones. He was a friend of Eisenhower's.
Alton Jones was a name that kept coming up. He was clearly prepared to buy Mossadegh's oil. I think Thornburg and his associates, whoever they may have been, would have been prepared to move some of that oil. And again, I come back to my feeling that Mossadegh was encouraged by channels, by connections that I know nothing of, to believe that the Americans would take care of him. And you could never persuade me that there were not people who would buy Iranian oil. There obviously were. And Mossadegh, in other words, may have been working on a perfectly reasonable assumption, except for his misunderstanding of the American-British relationship.
That's very interesting. Do you recall if any U.S. oil company representatives passed through Tehran during this period? Now, you mentioned Thornburg being president of Tehran, in Tehran for some time.
Well, Thornburg was living there, and he was not, as far as I know, representing an American company.
Yeah, he was a company, right?
He was a buccaneer.
Yeah. Yeah. Wasn't he an advisor to there was an American consulting firm working with the Iranian government on its development plans?
Perhaps.
Yeah. But besides Thornburg, were there any other people that passed through?
I know Jones came through,
yeah.
But I couldn't
there.
Tell you when,
yeah.
And I couldn't tell you whether I was in Washington or in Iran at that time. And I have no doubt that others came through, but I don't remember.
Did you get a sense when you were in Tehran or back at the country desk in Washington whether U.S. oil firms had much interest in taking part in the long-run development of Iranian oil resources?
Well, I've thought about that a lot since those days, partially because historians like you and others are suggesting that it's an amazing coincidence that the Americans were able to move in profitably. And the constant suggestion that they had nothing to do with Mossadegh coming to power. However, my personal opinion, based on what knowledge I have, uh-huh. is that the American oil companies, the major oil companies, did not in any way suggest to Mossadegh that they would pick up whatever Mossadegh could clear the British off of. So I would stand on the fact, my belief, that the American oil companies did not mount any kind of conspiracy to get the British out of Iran. I do think that Mossadegh expected them to take care of him.
He thought that the short-term interest would encourage them to take
I
to
just
take
think
British, or,
Mossadegh worked in a typically Persian world of the Americans would not allow Russia to control Iran. The Americans were the new power and owed nothing to the British, and that if he kicked out the British and threatened the Americans with a Russian hegemony, that we'd rush in. He wasn't that far wrong. We did, in the end. But I don't think that there was any kind of American oil company conspiracy. It was just a remarkable stroke of coincidental luck for them.
Yeah. Okay. Now, on September 51, Roy Henderson replaced Henry Grady as ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you talked a little bit about Henderson earlier, but how would you characterize Henderson?
Well, first of all, I have to make clear that My personal involvement with Loy Henderson extended over a number of years. I served with him in Tehran on his staff, then I was desk officer while he was ambassador, and then a few years after that, he called me back from I was stationed in Paris at that time, to be one of his special assistants in Washington, and I served him for 3.5 years. So I'm not only a great admirer, I also am very fond of him. And having said that, I go back to when he arrived in Tehran, he was a complete, I mean really a dramatic change from Mr. Grady, without in any way trying to say one was better than the other. The fact is, without any question, that Mr. Henderson was a more certain person in dealing with the quagmire and walking across the bog of Iranian politics. Hmm. And also, Mr. Grady had laid the groundwork. Grady had done a great deal of hard, honest work trying to negotiate with Mossadegh. By the time Henderson came, it had been clear that almost all avenues had been exhausted. So Henderson came in my view, with an instruction to do what he could, but mainly to set up lines of communication to Mossadegh and to the Shah, upon which we could build something new. And of course, that's what he did. I don't think he had instructions when he arrived to develop an overthrow of Mossadegh. I really don't think that. Your records perhaps could show that I'm wrong, but I don't think that's what he came instructed to do. I think he came instructed to try to restore some steadiness to a situation which was a very difficult situation.
But that corresponds to what I've read. Mm-hmm. That corresponds to what I've read, that there was no aim at that point of overthrowing Mossadegh. Now, how effective was he in working with Iranian officials, with Mossadegh or the Shah, among others?
Well, Loy Henderson is one of the great classic diplomats of all time. He's a man of astonishing honesty, sincerity, gentleness, and a wonderful mind. He's just an extraordinary man. And he treated the Shah with absolute sincerity and respect, but Henderson himself did not have any illusions. Nonetheless, he certainly never gave the Shah any sense of looking down on him or treating him as a less than emperor of emperors. In his dealings with Mossadegh, one of the first things he did was drop me as the interpreter and persuaded Mossadegh to have Saleh accompany him so that the negotiations could be in Persian. We still did not have a Farsi speaker on the embassy staff, although I think the CIA surely by this time had several. Well, I'll pause there.
Okay. How did he manage the embassy, say compared to Grady or Wiley?
Well, I don't remember exactly, but when did we move from the old German embassy? In any case, a building was constructed in the embassy compound, which was given the name of Henderson Hall. It was a very unoriginal architectural creation. But Henderson worked in that office, and his staff was in that building. He's a fine manager. He dealt with his staff through the DCM and directly with the CIA. He had very good very good relations with the CIA chief, who was Roger Guaron, uh-huh. Still there. And I'll just tell you one story, which I've always remembered this. in order to soothe Mr. Henderson's deep suspicions of the CIA, which any sensible ambassador would hold, they said to him, the people in Washington said to him, Loy, you can, anytime you want, you can call for the Kron file of our telegrams. This is a tremendous concession to a State Department officer. And so, having told him that, Mr. Henderson didn't call for it. He accepted that as a very fine gesture of respect and confidence. And one day, months later, he didn't have much to do, and so he called for the file. And some secretary who knew...
What was the file called?
The chronological file. The Kron file of telegrams. The past several. We kept up a couple of months. So the secretary in the CIA office, which was in the same building, knowing the standing instructions, simply trotted it down. And Mr. Henderson began to leaf through it. And about the fifth or sixth telegram was one saying, "Don't show to Loy." Anyhow, he had excellent relationships with all the people on his staff. He had been, he inherited a .4 program run by a remarkable man named Warren, W-A-R-N-E, who came out of California, and he may still be alive, I don't know, and who I think had been brought in by Grady. Grady had been very active in developing aid programs. Uh-huh. And Bill Warren and the ambassador got on, and then I know this happened. Warren wanted to do something, I don't remember what it was, some program. And Mr. Henderson wouldn't say no, but he did point out several potential pitfalls, some problems, and let Warren make his own decision. Warren went ahead and did it, and it turned out to be a disaster. Not a small disaster, but a disaster. And of course, ever after that, when Mr. Henderson made a suggestion or a comment, Warren paid a great deal more attention. And that's the way that Mr. Henderson ran things. He was an autocrat, a very definite person, but he would always give you a long lead and let you work on your own. Mm-hmm. Wonderful man. Mm-hmm.
Now at this stage, I think the embassy staff is expanding considerably.
By then I couldn't even, when I was desk officer, I couldn't even begin to guess how many Americans were there. But we had military missions. See, when I arrived, there was no military mission. The gendarmerie had been kicked out. So there were military missions. There were aid missions, point four and aid. I'm not sure where the line drew, if any. The staff was just blossoming. I would say the political section had at least four people in it. And pretty soon we began to have Farsi speakers.
Uh-huh. What accounted for the expansion of the embassy staff, not leaving aside the armistice and so forth?
Well, the embassy staff expanded in direct correspondence to the interest of Washington in Iran. In 1949, as I say, Washington really felt, let the British run it, and we got much bigger things to do. We have Europe and the Far East and so on.
Okay. Did you get as you said, you were a junior person at this stage, but did you get a sense of what Henderson thought about Mossadegh and the nationalization issue generally?
Well, of course, by this time I was looked upon as somebody who had a real working knowledge of Mossadegh.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I have a distinct memory of sitting in the office when Mr. Henderson would make his report. He'd come back from working with Mossadegh, and he'd make his report both to us and to Washington. He did it frequently in the form of dictating a report, and as he dictated, we could ask questions or make comments. And my recollection is that Henderson's first attitude toward Mossadegh was one of of treating him openly and continuing to try to work out some negotiation, some negotiated settlement with the British, which would meet British and American concerns. It seems to me I was either in the passage of home leave and going to the desk as Henderson's attitude changed. I don't remember the exact date of my moving to the desk, but as I say, I was on the desk while Acheson was still secretary. The decision to overthrow Mossadegh was made, I believe, by Beadle Smith, who was then undersecretary, and who, as you know, had come from a post in CIA, and who had been chief of staff to Eisenhower, so that you had a very tight family relationship there. You had Eisenhower as president, John Foster Dulles as secretary of state, his brother Allen as the head of CIA, and Beadle Smith, having been the closest associate of Eisenhower during the war and having been the deputy in CIA, now was the deputy in the State Department. And so when Beadle spoke, he spoke not only with direct instructions, but also with a deep understanding of what his principals were thinking. And I certainly was not present, but I've been told this by someone who was present, that CIA officers were in his office in the State Department. And Beadle, who had a very bad stomach problem, may have clutched his stomach and groaned, or he may have said, dump him. But I have a feeling the decision was made that easily and that quickly. And then CIA went to work. Now, they obviously did not work without involving Mr. Henderson. They changed the chief of station in Iran. Raja Guaran, I think, objected. In any case, he was transferred.
So that's interesting, because I think, he, according to the records I've seen, he left in the fall of 52, before the Ajax plan was even... So other people have said that same thing, that he objected, but I'm not sure.
What did he object to?
I don't know.
Well, yeah. I don't have it from his mouth, so maybe it's better if I don't even mention it.
Yeah.
But he's certainly worth talking to, and he's, as I say, he's healthy and sharp down in Florida right now. But they changed the chief of station. Henderson, I believe, now I understand that there have been interviews with him on this general subject.
Yes.
But I believe that Mr. Henderson had a deep reluctance to have a covert operation displace a chief of state. I think he had a long-term reluctance and a long-term sense of uneasiness about what this might do to the future. At the same time, I think that he faced a situation where there was very little alternative to the departure of Mossadegh. Now, I was on the desk, and as you probably know, I'm sure you know, you have the desk and then you have GTI, which is Greek, Turkey, and Iran. And the head of that was Arthur Richards, who had been my DCM in Tehran and now was my chief again in Washington. Above that, you have the assistant secretary for Middle East Affairs, who was Hank Byrod, I guess.
I think so.
And then above that, directly above that, you have the Secretary of State, and to the extent he involves his top people, undersecretaries. The line was drawn at the assistant secretary level in terms of discussions of plans to overthrow Mossadegh. I think at a stage Arthur Richards was informed. But the line was clearly drawn at the assistant secretary level and never got down to me. However,